Your karma determines what physical body you come into. Okay, you were going to be male. You came into Guatemala. You came into a family that started in Guatemala but left from there. You managed to find yourself from the east to the west coast. You were born at a certain time. You have a certain physique. Okay, and yet you are none of those things. You are really the infinite spirit. Anandamoyi Ma was born into a physical body at a particular time in certain ways. And she never allowed any of those realities to define her because she was always in the infinite spirit. And even from childhood, her body would assume certain yoga postures. You know, she did learn to speak the language around her, but her sense of herself and her consciousness was always attuned to the infinite. That's why when Master asked her about her life, I was a young girl, I was a baby, I was the same, I was a young girl, I was the same. They married me to this man, I was the same. You see me standing in front of you, I am the same. The body grew around her and everything, but she never became any of those things. She held her position in the infinite. You, me, everyone else in this room, we have assumed the characteristics of the world that we found ourselves in. And the world we found ourselves in was the exact proper world for us to be in, given our karma. You know, I was born a Jewish girl in Texas. You were born a Guatemala, am I correct? A Guatemalan man. You know, you're strong, you can lift things. I'm a little bit puny. I mean, English is my first language. You speak two languages, I only speak one. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things. Just let's start there and go on. You've fathered children, I have no children, you know, lots of different things. All of those things you did because you, well, we use the word imitated, but your infinite soul started behaving according to the context in which the body found itself. And so that's who you've become. It's a very interesting way to think about ourselves because, you know, who am I? Well, I'm Asha, and this is who I am. I'm Edwin, this is who I am, but not really. You're the infinite spirit who got into the habit of being Edwin. And you started figuring out how to be Edwin by watching your brothers and your mother and your father, you know. This is how you behave when you're in this family. So you started behaving that way. You probably walk a little bit like your brothers, or if you have brothers, or you know what I mean. You just figured it out. And every so often you see somebody in a family even who just never picked up anything from that family. But that gentleman who used to be with us, Pavani's friend, who was a ballet master. Some of you may remember him. He helped us. His name escapes me at the moment. He helped us some. He was this wonderful professional ballet man. And he sometimes choreographed, did some things with our choir and stuff. It was marvelously fun. He was the 12th child in a cattle ranching family in Texas. And he was a little weird in the family that he was in. You know, he's a very delicate, you know, very lovely, delicately built person. I mean, he had, you know, 11 older siblings who were all into being Texas cattle ranchers. He became a California ballet dancer. You know, it was a little strange for him. And he never really figured out how to be like any of them. He just went and did something else. Now, he's imitative still in the sense of he wasn't like Anandamoyi Ma, but he definitely didn't pick up his immediate environment, that's for sure. Does that help?
Yes.
Okay. It's a good question. It's a fascinating point. Yeah. When you really think about what we have to do to transcend the ego, comments like that, I mean, that whole concept of everything that I picked up, I was just imitating what was going on around me, it helps us get some slight picture of how much we have to change in order to be really free. Okay, yes.
It also indicates how weak the ego is. We have to constantly keep feeding it.
Oh, that's a very nice way to put it. We have to don't turn it off, just leave it on. We have to constantly keep affirming it all the time. And some people,
it's not true at some level.
Yeah, it's definitely not true at some level. So we keep working at it. Some people, you know, it's so odd, you know, paradoxically, The people who seem to have the strongest egos, which is, say, the most assertive egos, are the ones who are constantly affirming their ego, really, because they're always pushing themselves out in their egoic form. That really hearty sort of, look at me, here I am, or sort of energy where the people who are the most relaxed don't have to do that at all. Interesting. Okay, any other questions? All right, I went very far afield from where I said I was going to go last week, so now I'm going to do exactly what I wanted to do last week, which was that Swami starts this class by saying, read Whispers number 24, Call to My Guru. So I thought I would just go sentence by sentence through Whispers number 24. First, I think I'll read the whole thing, and then I think I'll just go back through it and we'll just do it sentence by sentence. These whispers of masters are model prayers. And what he's doing with all of these prayers and whispers is he's teaching us how to pray. He's teaching us how to have the right attitude toward everything. It's a really interesting book, which is one of the reasons why Swami wanted to re-edit it, because he wanted the meaning of all of those poems to be really crystal clear to us. You know, when I've given classes on the subject of the Book of Whispers, one of the ways that I've taught it, among others, is to just say, okay, here's how you deal with the fact that you don't have a job. Here's how you deal with the fact that people are mad at you. Here's how you deal with the fact that you're sad about something. Because then Master would have a poem about how to have a divinely centered attitude on that subject. So I haven't really sort of, we'll do it now, but this is the poem that's a tribute to my guru. So that's what it's called, My Guru. Thou light of my life. This is Master talking to Sri Yukteswar. But of course, in this, he's telling us how to relate to the Master. My Guru, thou light of my life, thou camest to spread wisdom's glow over the path of my soul. Centuries of darkness dissolved before the shafts of thy luminous help. As a naughty baby, I cried for my mother divine, and she came to me as my guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar. At that meeting, O my guru, a spark flew from thee, and the faggots of my God craving, gathered through incarnations, smoldered and blazed into bliss. All my questions have been answered with thy flaming golden touch. Eternal, ever-present satisfaction has come to me through thy glory. My Guru, thou voice of God, I found thee in response to my soul cries. Slumbers of sorrow are gone, and I am awake in bliss. If all the gods are displeased, yet thou art pleased, I am safe in the fortress of thy pleasure. And if all the gods protect me behind the parapets of their blessings, yet I receive not thy benedictions, I am an orphan, left to pine spiritually in the ruins of thy displeasure. O Guru, thou didst bring me out of the bottomless pit of darkness into the paradise of peace. Our souls met after years of waiting. They trembled with an omnipresent thrill. We met here because we had met before. Together we will fly to his shores, where we will smash our planes of finitude forever and vanish into infinite light, into infinite life. I bow to thee, as the spoken voice of silent God. I bow to thee as the divine door which leads to the temple of salvation. I bow to thee, to thy master Lahiri Mahashaya, harbinger of yoga in Benares, and I lay the flowers of my devotion at the feet of Babaji, our supreme Master. It's a beautiful poem. Okay, So why don't we just start at the beginning? He calls his guru, "Thou light of my life, thou camest to spread wisdom's glow over the path of my soul." You know, in the Festival of Light, we have that part. Greater can no love be than this, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of mankind. Such ever has been the sacrifice of the great masters for the world. Now, that's just such a beautiful phrase in itself, and there is this... well, another part of the festival, it says, you know, we wandered through, what is reality? For what end were we made? That's the question. All that I thought was light was but darkness. You know, what is reality? For what end we were made? And then the line is, ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. And what he's talking about there is the return of the avatar and the return of the guru, which is that we as human beings just don't really quite know where we're going. I was having a conversation with someone today just about why is life like it is? And the issue was sort of trying to answer that unanswerable question, why is it like it is? And you can't answer that question. It gets very complicated to sort of answer that question properly, but I think what I was trying to say. But ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. That there are these, you know, fully self-realized masters who walk the earth with us, and they just come for one reason only. They don't have any intention of their own, any necessity of their own. They just radiate the light. Guru means lifter of darkness, bringer of light. And that, you know, they... So somebody was wanting to use the word guru about a very negative person. You know, so-and-so was the guru of that terrible movement, whatever it was. I said, you can't use guru because guru means dispeller of darkness. So you can't call somebody the guru of darkness because the word means dispeller. So in the life of Yogananda, he acts out for us this extremely compelling desire for a master. So then he calls the guru, "Thou light of my life. Thou camest to spread wisdom's glow over the path of my soul." So his master was a wisdom-oriented avatar, but of course wisdom is a word that all of us relate to. And he starts with just this understanding that this messenger of the infinite is the point from which all emanates in my life. And the more sort of simply, and that's what as we go through this is just what he points out to us. This is an awakened son who comes to answer the questions that we have. And that light of understanding goes over the path of my soul. Centuries of darkness dissolved before the shafts of thy, he loved this phrase, luminous help. You know, he just beautiful poetic word. And this is another point. Centuries of darkness dissolve. It's like it doesn't make any difference where we've been, what we've done, what we haven't done. As soon as you are in the presence of light, there is no darkness anymore. And it's such a strange reality, but it's something also that we have to continually remember, because just meeting the guru, just finding our guru, is not the end of the story, because we all keep slipping back. You know, we do things that we're ashamed of. We become off-center and make mistakes. We lose momentum on the spiritual path. Centuries of darkness dissolved before the shafts of thy luminous help. So we have to sort of always keep that in mind. It doesn't really make any difference what's gone on in our lives. It all just simply disappears, and uses that word, thy luminous help, as soon as we take the master's help in. Now the other factor about the guru, which is really important, is that he does not impose his will on us. If we don't draw that help, if we don't magnetize it to ourselves, it just simply isn't there. I actually finally figured out a sort of peculiar quality about Swami Kriyananda, who to me has sort of acted out the way Master was. I said to Swamiji once, I said, the way you do things is the way Master did them, isn't it? He said, of course. And so by looking at the way you handle situations and respond to people, we're looking at the way Master did it. He said again, of course. And if Master didn't do something, then you don't do it either. He said, of course. You know, so a lot of time I can just think about how he's behaved. And Swamiji can be very magnetic, or he can be not particularly magnetic. And I don't mean that he himself changes, but sometimes I've seen that when people want to come and have him persuade them, is the only way I can think to say it, it's almost like he becomes almost non-existent. It's like if he's going to have to push against your resistance, he's just not going to do it. It's like the help is there, but it's like luminous help is the way, I'm reading too much into this, but luminous is it just simply glows. And you can step into that light or you cannot step into that light, but that light's not going to chase you. You know, it has to be a response on your part. If people are interested, Swamiji will talk all day and all night. If people are just wanting to argue with him, he just doesn't engage. It's very sort of puzzling to watch. As a naughty baby, Master loves to use that phrase, I cried for my Mother Divine, and she came to me as my guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar. You know, you think of Sri Yukteswar as a very masculine form, but the Divine Mother is the comforter. And so as a naughty baby, he calls us naughty babies, meaning that we're not going to be satisfied with playthings anymore. We're just going to keep crying out for the Mother to come to us. And she came to me as my guru. And it helps us to sort of realize that that force which guides us out of our suffering and our delusion, it is always it's a mother image. It's a mother image because it's a feminine force that protects and saves us. So the guru has all those qualities within him. You don't think of Sri Yukteswar as a mother in his personality. But it's, and the other side of that is, the master is not an egoic personality. It's not him that's doing it. It's the force of the divine behind him. So he was acting as Divine Mother's instrument only. At that meeting, O my guru, a spark flew from thee, and the faggots of my God craving, gathered through incarnations, smoldered and blazed into bliss. Incredible, isn't that? You know, not all of us, obviously, are fortunate enough to have such a dramatic meeting. Even when Swami Kriyananda was writing the first part of The Path, and he tells the story of his parents being in Egypt and him finding the autobiography of a yogi by, you know, being forced, physically turned against his own conscious decision to go to the bookstore and get the book, reading Autobiography of a Yogi, going right across the country. We were in Hawaii in the summer of 76. He was editing that part of the book. And I said, Swamiji, it's, you know, like, nobody has a story like this. Nobody else had that happen to them. Most of us, you know, wake up really slowly and then gradually we sort of find our way. Swami's response was interesting. He said, I know. He said, that's sort of a drawback in my autobiography because almost no one else has experiences where they have such instantaneous recognition and such a total ability to turn their life around. And then he sort of shrugged. He said, but that's how it's happened, so that's the story I have to tell. But in a sense, it's like the way we love to read romantic stories or see romantic movies. Not everybody does. But you know, the romance where the couple struggles and then they finally get together and there's this great sense of, oh, isn't this wonderful and isn't this sweet? And it sort of lifts our heart over the years. As leaders of Ananda, David and I have had to perform a lot of weddings. And I'm not very sentimental, really, or very romantic by nature. At the beginning, the weddings were not that easy for me to perform because, you know, it's a lot of that. But I finally actually realized that what we're doing when we make a wedding is like, for a few minutes, we're going into the astral world. It's like we're creating this just perfect experience of something really blissful and uplifting, because then it can be like a benchmark that we can always come back to. And it actually completely changed my attitude toward it because I just suddenly understood what it was all about, at least in its highest form. And so to a certain extent, these stories of these really profound longings and then fulfilled. It's like we read them and we read them again and again, because even if that's not the facts of our story, that's the spirit of our story. And, you know, that's the spirit of just this tremendous God longing. And then he writes there that just a spark from his guru and all the inner reality just burst into bliss. And even, again, if our own story is less dramatic, you can still feel what that would be like. And we can put ourselves into that consciousness. I had a very interesting experience not too long ago, which is related to this, but not exactly. You know, all of us have deep-seated karmic impressions. And I've talked to you sometimes just about just certain memories that are not quite conscious memories, but you know, you feel fears in your heart, you feel a certain pain in your heart sometimes, loneliness, resentment. Sometimes it has specific forms. Sometimes there's people in your life that you're uncomfortable with or that you just can't quite forgive, stuff like that. I was sort of trying to work my way through what I know to be a past life memory that sticks with me in the present, and then I just can't shake it. I've been trying to shake it for a really long time. I had two experiences with it. First was just saying to myself, I really need to just let go of these limiting feelings. And I knew that I wanted to, and I knew that I didn't want to. You know, it's just somehow you get comfortable in those limiting feelings. And if you feel like people don't understand you and you want them to understand you, you want them to understand you, and then you'll be willing to let go. You know, it's just, it's very, very annoying. And I just kept trying to talk myself out of this for a long time. And then I thought of Swamiji's consciousness, because I know it better than I know any other. And I appreciate how universally loving he is. I mean, you could use Master or Christ, it doesn't matter, or just even an image of Divine Mother, but I was able to think of Swamiji. And when I had been meditating, just sort of trying to relinquish these feelings and reasoning with myself, but instead what I did, I tried to visualize what Swamiji's consciousness was like. I know many of you all, a few years ago when Swami had had the cancer in his stomach and we were all praying for him for a while, some people mentioned something to me that was very interesting. When they started praying for Swamiji, their consciousness linked to his in a way that it hadn't done before, because they'd never concentrated on him in that way. And when their consciousness linked to his, they found that they were experiencing his consciousness. In other words, they're being drawn in to the place where he lives, you know, which is a very blissful and a very loving place. So I deliberately, by an act of will and by the practice of Kriya, using Kriya also, I just lifted my consciousness to try to match his vibration, with the very strong thought that in his vibration, those feelings couldn't exist, because they would be contradicted by his consciousness. And I suddenly saw this is a much better way to try to get out of these things, because you can't talk yourself out of them. But if you put yourself into a different vibration and then really give yourself to that vibration, then of necessity you have to leave the others behind. And I must say, it was very impressive. You know, just when I came out of that one meditation, I really felt shifted. You know, it's something I'd been trying to do for a really long time. I just felt shifted. Now, you know, what that's about, that's Master's vibration through Swamiji. When I access Swami's vibration, I always feel like I'm accessing Master, because he's a disciple. So when you access him, you're accessing discipleship to Master. That's how the seeming contradiction of personalities is resolved, at least in my own awareness. His attunement is with Master, so attunement with him is attunement with Master. Whether you go through the doorway of his frame or not is your decision. But the power of that spark, you know, to set your own awareness ablaze, which is the phrase that he's using here, it can't be underestimated. And what I'm really saying by all this, which is what all this we get to talk about for you know, several classes here, attunement is everything. Because when you're in tune with that vibration, you're automatically not in tune with the things that limit you. And that's why Master says, just be in tune. Because if you're in tune, if you're consciously holding your awareness into that reality, it can't simultaneously hold delusion. Yes.
Is it possible then that there are things we don't work through in the sense that we think of it, but rather we just lift our consciousness to a different vibration and sort of transcend it that way?
It's not only possible, that is exactly what happens.
Sort of like cutting the Gordian knot?
It's cutting the Gordian knot. It's dissolving the vrittis. Okay, what we're working through is, instead of energy flowing in a smooth pattern, you know, just through the center of the spine, like a river flowing, there are vrittis of attachments and confusions and pains and so on. And so if you think of a river trying to run straight through the channel to the sea, but you think over here are some rocks and here are some logs and here's some grass caught, so a lot of that water does not go straight. It just whirls. It just whirls in a whirlpool. Literally, that's what a vritti is. So I have an aspiration, you have an aspiration to lift my consciousness to God. But on the way to lifting my consciousness to God, I have a lot of it pre-committed. It has to be mad at somebody who got upset with me the other day. It has to be upset about how I was mistreated 5,000 years ago. It has to be insecure about, you know, whether I'm ever going to be good enough for this. It has to be sad because I failed to, you know, get married and have children when I could have done that. You know, it has to be worried over here because it murdered somebody and never got caught. It has to be worried over here because that person is trying to murder me now. You know, I mean, you don't even begin to know. Swamiji said, the vrittis of millions of incarnations are in your spine. So if you actually thought about working through all of those, you know, however, kriya. Because if the river is flowing and the whirlpools are sucking off the water, and so that the delivery, I think of it as the delivery, you know, there's an order placed for energy from the spiritual eye, and it has to go to the medulla, and it kind of has to sweep around. But it's a UPS van, and it has to drop off a lot of the packages along the way. So by the time it gets here, the box is not nearly as full as it would be because so much of it had to be poured out into all those vrittis. But if the river's running like that, you can undo the vrittis. You can, you know, go in there and pull everything apart and take the grass out and the rocks and get all tumbled around. And that is sort of like one way, and then finally the vritti merges into the river. The other thing you can do is make the river flow with more and more power. The more powerful the river flows, the vrittis, because it's a magnetic relationship. The attachment of the ego to what's ever holding that vritti in place only has so much force. And if the river becomes more powerful, it's just swept in. And you don't even ever know what happened. I mean, sometimes it causes a little tumult, but often it just doesn't. You just gradually feel better and better. And you have more and more energy. And you start responding very differently to life. And you're not as worried about 1,000 million things. And when so-and-so comes who you used to hate, you can't remember why you hated them. Because you've been doing kriya. And the kriya has been pulling and making the center flow of the river stronger and stronger. And the stronger it gets, the more and more vrittis are just automatically dissolved into it. So really, all you have to do is kriya. And you don't really have to do anything else if you can do kriya all the time and do it well. But you do it in an adjunct with right living and karma yoga and everything else. But ultimately what frees you is when that river is strong enough to dissolve the vrittis. Does that make sense?
So when you say work them out, you mean like live out that karmic pattern?
You mean you don't have to work them out because you don't have to live it out. Because see, the only reason... I keep like, it's like my spleen or my appendix I keep pointing to here, but it's like you need to dissolve the vritti. And there's several ways to dissolve the vritti. One is to go through an external experience in which you learn whatever it is that the vritti is about. The other is just to dissolve it and then it's gone in any case. Oh, I was going to say, the only reason external things happen to you is because of the vrittis in the spine create a certain magnetic field, and then that magnetic field draws things to you. You know, maybe a desire for revenge, or the need to be punished, or the desire to love someone, or to meet a certain person. It's a kernel, egoically attached thought around which energy spins. And if it spins strong enough, and you can't dissolve it any way, it will come to you. That accounts for everything that happens. Everything is because of the vrittis in the spine. But if that vritti is dissolved this way, then there's nothing to draw it to you.
Is the longing for God manifested as a vritti as
no,
well?
No, the longing for God is the flow of the energy up the spine. It's not a... people could talk about it as blocks in the chakras. They're not really blocks, they're holes. It's the opposite. It's that the energy is trying to flow, guided by the spiritual eye, only to the spiritual eye. That's why we do Kriya from the spiritual eye. Because doing Kriya from the spiritual eye commands all the other chakras. But when the energy is on its way up, there's a hole in the chakra. And so instead of it remaining in the center, it goes out. I mean, it goes out either into the vritti or it goes out into desires. So the energy is drained out. People call it that it's blocked. But that it really, it being blocked isn't as clear as the fact that it's dissipated. On the level, on that level, instead of being guided from the spiritual eye. Now understand, even when you're guided from the spiritual eye, you still act according to the qualities of each chakra, because the qualities of all the chakras are required to make you a balanced person. You need the earth element, the water element, the fire element. But they can either, the fire can either be expressed at its highest dimension, which is self-discipline in harmony with God, or it can be expressed on its own level, which is self-will in pursuit of my own desires. So it's not like any of them are bad. It's just a question of whether they are elevated to the guidance of Christ consciousness, or whether they're just expressed on the level of egoic satisfaction. And if there's holes, if there's leaks, it comes out guided by ego. And if those leaks are plugged, then it comes out guided by the spiritual eye. And then you have fiery self-will, but it's used to find the truth, not merely to lead one into more and more vrittis, which will take you down another pathway again for another million or so incarnations. Does that make sense? It's very, very, very important information. For one reason, it keeps you meditating and doing Kriya when you might be tired of doing it. And it also just helps you understand, you know, this is just always a metaphysical balance, and if I don't like what's happening, I can always influence it. And on the other side of it, it helps you to understand these are powerful forces, and I can't just wish them away. You know, I've spent lots of incarnations getting this confused. And it takes a little while. Because if you've been building a really strong vritti, just because it suddenly occurred to you that that was a bad idea, doesn't mean that just suddenly occurring to you that it's a bad idea can dissolve it, because it has a strong magnetic force. So you have to work on the kriya, and you have to work on the right attitude and everything that's in relation to it. You also have to respect those vrittis, and you don't play around. You don't just say, oh, I can just do this, I can go there, I can go to this place, I can have a little few drinks, you know, I can go find a few women, you know, big deal, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, there are very strong forces inside of you. You don't know what you're activating and how deep the hole is. So you try to live the right life, because, one, it starves those vrittis and doesn't create new ones, it also increases the up and down flow. And on the other hand, if you do, you know, succumb to temptations that you'd prefer not to succumb to, it's just a little another vritti in the spine. I'll just do a few more kriyas and I'll just try to, you know, everything can be overcome by the grace of God. Is that helpful? Yeah. Okay, anything else? Yes, Nitik, do you want to get, we record this, and a lot of people listen, so if your question needs to be on there. The microphone is the tip of that little bundle of wires.
So I'm new, so maybe this question might be a no wise question.
Let's hear it.
And I haven't learned Kriya as yet,
right.
But one of the things that I understood through some readings, and I wanted more clarity on it, was the fact that whenever you notice these thoughts that your ego is trying to attach onto, and you are aware of those, one of the things that I read is helpful is just to try to focus your attention in the present moment.
Right.
And by present moment is, again, whatever techniques you know to become still.
Right.
Try doing those.
Right.
Do those help as a, maybe for someone like me who is beginning and still hasn't reached the point of kriyas?
Well, we're all beginning, no matter whether we're doing kriya or not. But I mean, the implication of those thoughts is those thoughts are past or future oriented, that you're concerned about imaginary events that are not really happening right now. So the more we can live in the present moment, the more our attention and concentration is not divided, which is always a good idea. Most of the techniques for getting into the present moment involve the breath. And the fact of the matter is the breath is the only enduring reality of our entire life. And the breath also has a very strong relationship. The state of your breath and the state of your consciousness are very closely related. When I first heard that, I was a much more emotional person, and I remember being really upset about something, and I started to cry about it. And I just realized, I remember that, well, gee, if I just do deep, even rhythmic breathing. So I did, and I found you cannot breathe evenly and deeply and rhythmically and cry at the same time. And so I was just, you know, calming down, but I just thought I didn't want to be calmed down, so I went back to crying. But it was just like when the breath is calm and you're concentrating on it, by its very nature, it changes your state of mind. So absolutely it's useful. And kriya is just a very sophisticated use of that. It's the same principle. It's the same principle of you go into the breath and then you go to what's behind the breath. Because the energy up and down the spine is actually the causative force of the breath itself. So definitely any technique that causes you to focus in the present moment, especially on the breath, especially at the spiritual eye. Because then you're really cooperating with all those forces. And that's really the beginning of kriya. Kriya is not so incomprehensible. And you start there and then you go farther if you want to. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, any other questions before we go on with this? All right. And then he says, all my questions have been answered with thy flaming golden touch. Eternal, ever-present satisfaction has come to me through thy glory. You know, Master's so extravagant in his praise, isn't he? And it's really interesting when you realize that he himself was also, you know, fully God-realized, but he's also really acting out for us the attitude of a disciple. And it's a little, it's really, again, it's really something to contemplate. How extravagantly devoted and grateful Master expresses to his guru. And you know, you hear Swamiji talk about it all the time. He's just always talking about, he seems like such a big person in his own right, but he's always giving the credit back. And even Swamiji said, there's a story somewhere where Master was caught and couldn't do something. I can't remember what the details were, but he called on Sri Yukteswar and then he had the power to do it. And on another occasion, someone asked him, the specific question was, you speak of this being the church of all religions, but you only really talk about Hinduism and Christianity, or about Krishna and Christ. And why do you do that? And Master answered, it's the will of Babaji that I do that. And there was another question having to do with one of the disciples. Why are you doing this with one of the disciples? He said, it's the will of Babaji. And it's like, here he was, but still, his attention, both as an example and just as a fact, was always turned toward the source. And remember with Rajasi, he would say to Rajasi, now remember where your power comes from. And Rajasi would say, I'll remember, I'll never forget. It comes from you, sir. And here, Rajasi himself, too, was a great master. But the power comes from the guru. It's an attitude of mind that brings us into harmony with where we're supposed to be. You know, the whole battle is against a false sense of self. And one of the most powerful ways to get out of that sense of self is to really realize how Divine Mother reaches us through these great ones. All my questions have been answered. Isn't that just like, imagine, all my questions have been answered. Just think what that state of mind would be. I mean, it's not just you know, how did you create the world and why did you make us the way you are? But just think how many questions go through us. What's going to become of me? Why do I feel this way? Should I do this? Should I do that? I wonder if this is the right thing. You know, why did that happen? It's like it's not just what goes through our conscious mind. It's like this almost subconscious level in which all these unanswered realities are floating around. All these concerns, all these doubts. All my questions have been answered by thy flaming golden touch. The conversation I was having with someone today, he was asking me unanswerable questions, you know, the kind of philosophical questions. Some very interesting answers, though, came through me. This is the question of, why are we here? Why did God do this to us? What did Master say about why God did this to us? And I'll explain this to you because it's relevant here. Self-realization is not a dogma. It's an experience. Catholicism is a dogma. Somewhere along the way, the Catholics decided they would answer every question. At least I believe so, with all due respect to my Irish Catholic friends here and my South American Catholic friends. But that they would answer every question. So they have a theology answering pretty much every question. I know every so often you guys start in on your catechism and you just start and makes the rest of us just laugh our heads silly, but you all just, you know, give all these answers to all these questions. And they decided, you know, the babies get caught in limbo, what happens to unbaptized babies, and later they decided that that isn't what happened to unbaptized babies, but since you have to be baptized to be saved, well, what if you're not, you know, they answered every question. And then the church itself is its theology. And you study its theology, you become a master of its theology, and that's how you know things, because the idea was, we'll explain it. And this is what it is. So people come to our place and they naturally think that if they ask certain questions, there will be an answer. And the question that's often asked is, why did God make us? Why did my divine mother throw me out and separate me and cause me to suffer? And so you think there's an answer to that question. What is the theological position that Yogananda made on that question? And I realized, in trying to answer it, we're not a theology. We're an experience. And the answer to that question is, the answer to that question has always been, there is no answer to that question. Or the answer has always been, the level of consciousness that asks the question cannot understand the answer. That was Vivekananda's. Because we make no attempt to have a theological answer to things. We say, if you really want to know that, then conduct the proper experiment to have the right experience and know. It's a completely different way of looking at things. I've heard Swami say this many times, to define something is not the same. But I really got it today, and I really got it about our path. So it isn't really because we're too dumb to have an answer. It's because in self-realization, you don't try to answer all questions. You try to change your consciousness. And when you change your consciousness, then you perceive the reality of it. This was reminding me of the book that I've often quoted to you, that man who was the Catholic monk, who was a priest, very, very happy priest, for 25 years of his life. He became a theologian at the Vatican, very high level, a student of Catholicism, absolutely loved his life, but overworked and was put out on sabbatical for a while. So they sent him to Switzerland. And he, for the first time in his life, was just sitting and doing nothing because he just overworked. So he's just sitting there, literally doing nothing, on the balcony of his hotel, looking out over this beautiful Swiss valley. He has a mystical experience of God. And when he had a mystical experience of God, he realized that Catholicism was a fake. It was just a total fake, because it was nothing but definitions. And the definitions didn't have anything to do with the actual experience of God. So much to his total dismay, he had to resign from being a priest because he had thought that theology was religion. And he realized it was just words, experience is something else. That's why, Master, you know, there's a lot of intelligent answers to a lot of questions on our path. But when you get to the realm where it can't be answered, he just doesn't. Because that's not what we're doing. We're doing something completely other than that. Isn't that interesting? I was very interested myself when I thought of that. So when he says here, all my questions have been answered with thy flaming golden touch, That's really what he's saying. I don't have to ask anymore why I was made, because I know. What is reality? For what end was I made? Ever and again through your awakened sons, the answer comes. Now, I've always read that to mean that we have a scripture and it explains it to us. No, no, no. It's through the touch of the guru. When you receive that, then your consciousness is lifted and you know. All your questions are answered. This man who was interviewing Swamiji once for a magazine article just talked about how many questions he had. And he said, what's the answer to doubt? This man asked Swami. Swami said, peace. He said, peace is the answer to doubt. It's not the continual asking of questions and having them answered. It's the experience of inner peace. And then you no longer doubt. Well, what you don't doubt is the existence of that inner peace. And once you have enough experience of that, and it sort of has to go like this. You have a touch of experience, and you have enough experience that makes you want to pursue more of that experience. And when you pursue more of the experience, you have a little more, and then more and more questions are answered because you get into that state in which the questions no longer exist. Because the questions only exist when you're separated from yourself. When you're in the delusion and you think there's a problem. I was trying to answer this. You're not really separated from God ever. The answer to that question, why did God separate you from himself, is that he didn't. So you can't answer why he separated you from himself, because he never did. You just think he did. So you change the question. Why do I think he did? You know? But you kind of can keep spinning that. But if you think, you know, if I'm looking at you and I think you're mad at me, and then we talk together and I realize you're not mad at me at all, I don't have to like have this big explanation. Why, you know, why were you mad at me? Because you were never mad at me, right? It never happened. I just got confused. And then when you're unconfused, you're not confused anymore, so it's not a problem. You see how fun that is, though? But it's all about experience. All my questions were answered by thy flaming golden touch. Eternal, ever-present satisfaction has come to me through thy glory. Ah. Isn't that something to be devoutly hoped for? Okay, let's take a short break, and then we'll go through this poem and finish. Okay, Niti, go right ahead.
Wrote this one down, and the thought that came to my mind while you were reading the poem was, I guess, a fear that's been inside me, that is it my ego that's looking to find a guru, or even looking for God, because it's trying to escape again, like, all the things that are inside me. Because if it was true consciousness or true self of mine, it wouldn't be looking, because it would have realized.
Okay. I don't know what kind of background or reading you've been doing.
Okay.
But I think the word ego has gotten a little bit mixed up in your mind from the point of view of self-realization. So I'm going to start first by just talking about what ego really is. Because ego is not really your enemy. And to merely call something ego, people do that a lot. But who is calling what whom? You know, the part of you that thinks your ego is your enemy is your ego. So all you're really doing is just dividing yourself up into all these factions, you know, taking one piece and mixing it all up. And then you're also always, which your second question reflects, you're always having to second guess yourself, because you're really on all sides of the question. The definition Yogananda made of ego. Ego is the jiva, which is the individual expression of spirit identified with the physical body. But it's still the jiva. It's just the infinite spirit that thinks it's this body. And because it thinks it's this body, it does all sorts of things. It's fearful of death. It desires comfort. It has a sense of time. It's limited to one gender. It has a nationality. I mean, all the sorts of things I was talking about with Edwin. Those are not actual changes. Those are identifications, which is a very interesting word. You know, this is like a temporary who I think I am, but I'm not really that. Now, the other side of it is, so that's what ego is the jiva identified with. So, but you can see that's not like a hateful enemy. That's just a fact that we have to work with, because the other side of it is that ego is where is our self-awareness. And because we are human beings with highly developed ego, it's the ego itself that has sufficient self-awareness for it to be able to perceive its situation and to exercise enough willpower to shift its situation. Like a cat can't reflect in a kind of abstract way. If something comes and hurts it, it may run away, but it doesn't have the capacity to sort of reflect on suffering everywhere and cats in Africa and what they go through and, you know, is it really worth it to go on eating this dry food? Maybe, you know, it just can't do that because it has instincts, but it doesn't have self-awareness. So the ego is a great blessing because it gives us the self-awareness to try to decide. Okay, now, however, what that self-awareness is, above all, is it becomes self-awareness of the twin qualities, which is the possibility or the experience of suffering and the possibility or the experience of bliss. And absolutely everything is a decision made toward, away from suffering and toward bliss. Often the decisions are so stupid that they're actually toward suffering and away from bliss, but we think, nobody ever does anything that they don't think is going to diminish their suffering and increase their happiness. Even if they become heroin addicts, you know, they think it's going to help them somehow because, and we get all mixed up. But it's the ego that's able to make that decision. So it's really our friend because it helps us to navigate. But at a certain point, our sophisticated understanding of where sorrow comes from and where bliss can be found comes to, because of our egoic awareness, we begin to realize the problem is that my infinite has identified with the limited. And that is the fundamental cause of all my sufferings, because I have confined myself, my sense of self, to the small reality, when in fact my true reality is infinite. So then the ego motivates us to begin to try to do those things which are going to dissolve the ego. And any action that will ultimately lead to the dissolution of the ego is not ego-motivated. So the desire, I can't remember the exact context, but it was something about Swamiji's desire he wanted to be in Ananda Moya Ma's company when he was with her in the 60s. And he said, I feel selfish taking up so much of your time. And Ma answered him to this effect, how can that which will destroy all self be selfish? So any impulse that has its goal, the expansion of our consciousness into a greater identity, which is a better way to think of it, cannot be ego-based, because what you're trying to do is to transcend it. So we don't want to second-guess ourselves. Because yes, of course, it's individually motivated. It's what's called divine selfishness, Swami Master called it. Yes, it's selfish because it's in the interest of yourself to do it, but it's divine selfishness because what you're trying to do is you're trying to dissolve the self, because that's ultimately the most selfish thing you can do. Does that make sense? Okay. It's a good question. It's a very good question. And you know, you have to, let me just get one more thought here. You have to pick these things up by the right string, or else your mind just goes in circles. And one of the tremendous things about the way Swami Kriyananda has expressed Yogananda's teaching is that he just kind of takes you through all those labyrinths of confusions, even just what does the word ego mean? And getting in right relationship to your own ego is very, very important. I have so many friends who divide themselves against themselves, and I've just never seen it work. You're always on flipping from side to side. Just forget it, you know. It's just me. I'm just going to go forward, and gradually me, the word me, will just mean something else. And I don't have to really be worried about it anymore. Okay? Any other questions or thoughts on that? All right. Then Master says, my guru, thou voice of God, I found thee in response to my soul cries. Slumbers of sorrow are gone, and I am awake in bliss. Master often uses the images of being asleep and then being awake. When I was talking to this today also, to this person, we were just describing the whole path is one of ever-increasing wakefulness or awareness, whatever you call it. Because this man was saying to me that even as you become more blissful, in a certain way, all your sorrows become more poignant. Because what happens is your awareness increases. And I, whenever I teach beginning meditation classes, I say to people, you know, one thing you really need to know, and this is on the fourth class, is why you might stop meditating. And one of the reasons people stop meditating is because it begins to work, which sounds very weird. But when you meditate, you increase your awareness. And you often then become aware of things that you've been trying not to be aware of. Like how you really feel, or certain sadnesses that you have, or what the spiritual path is really like, and how much effort it's going to take to really become divinely successful. And after talking about how much you want to grow spiritually, when you become more aware of what that really means, sometimes you just decide that I think I'll just sit this incarnation out. And because your meditation is actually working for you. So he says in here, slumbers of sorrow are gone. And then that's where you have to really use your discrimination to understand that all suffering is because of the confinement of the infinite being identified with the limited. And that's what makes us asleep. We are not really limited, but we've become identified with it, so we're asleep. We're asleep to our actual magnificence. The reason Jesus was totally fearless is because he was one with the infinite. It just didn't make any difference what happened to him. I had this day once, it was just a second. I was just walking up the stairs, and it just kind of crossed my mind. Master was afraid of nothing. And I thought for a moment, what would it be like to be absolutely fearless and just have there be nothing in all of creation that could make you anxious? And just like for a second, I felt that. I was by no means the full magnitude of it, but just a glimpse of it. Think how many things we worry about. You know, pain, suffering, embarrassment, humiliation, stupidity, loss of loved ones, stubbing a toe. I was by myself in our cabin, our house at Ananda Village once years ago, and I was putting some wood into the fire, and I dropped a heavy piece of wood on my foot, and I was alone. It really hurt, and I became concerned that I might have actually really hurt it, and I didn't know how to tell. So I called up the clinic, and at that time, Jack Wallace was answering the phone. Some of you know him. And he took me through some exercises to confirm that it wasn't broken. In fact, pretty much to confirm there was nothing seriously wrong. And then all I said was, Jack, it hurts, and I want someone to know. And he's very, you know, effusive sort of person. So he spent a lot of time just feeling sorry for me, and he had me describe in detail how it hurt, and then he expressed all the sympathy. You know, it was just, I just wanted to be small and in pain, and I just didn't want to do it alone. You know, it was just like, there's just all these ways. And it was just, you know, I just dropped something on my foot. But think about what it would be like to be afraid of nothing. Think of that story in Autobiography of a Yogi, where the policemen are pursuing the man they think is a criminal who has disguised himself as a sadhu. They run up behind the man they think is the criminal. They order him to stop. He doesn't stop. The policeman raises his machete. I mean, this is a pretty brutal thing. His axe. He cuts off the man's arm. And when he cuts off the arm, the sadhu, as it turns out, not the criminal, he picks up the arm and he reattaches it. That's the first thing he does. And he turns to the policeman and he says, I'm not the criminal you're seeking. You know, just like, you know, a policeman has cut his arm off and he just doesn't even react. He just puts it back on again and says, you know, the guy you're looking for is over there, it's not me. But think of the consciousness. Master says something that, you know, not most parents don't like, but he says, don't coddle your children too much. He says, don't always put a sweater on them when they're cold. You know, don't always rush to give them food when they just first say they're hungry. And I say that to some parents, and the parents get really upset. But you have to hear it in the right way. He says, don't train them that every little tiny whim and desire has to be immediately fulfilled. You know, raise them up to be a little tough. And that's not out of anything except, why not? Just like sometimes Master will say things and your head will just turn around completely. Because you were so trained to think we should be so attentive, and then we have all these incredible long psychological stories about what happens if you let them cry too much and all of these sorts of things, which are not untrue. But Master just put something completely else out there. Why should we always be training our young people to think that every little tiny whim they have, you know, is so important that they can't endure for even a split second because five or six adults are going to run around and solve it? You know, what kind of a picture of reality and what kind of strength does that give them? I remember Prakash at Ananda Village. He grew up on a farm in Kentucky. He has a real southern way of speaking. His whole family was there. The first summer that I was at Ananda Village, or first early years, he had a really strong Kentucky accent and Kentucky manners, and he had this straw hat. And I just remember he saw me one night and he said, "Evening, Miss Asha," tipped his hat to me like that. He wasn't kidding. It was just like that, how he responded. He said his father used to come in every morning really early. He'd be sound asleep in bed. His father would reach for the covers, pull the covers off in the sleeping child and say, "Rise up, son." Prakash said it made him a very, very early riser because he'd always want to be awake before that happened. That was just his father's way. "Rise up, son." And well, who knows what you want to say about it. But it's, you can see. And so we're grown-ups now. But think about it. You know, when things happen to us, do we have to satisfy every single desire? Can we just endure for a minute? You know, I'm a great one for when there's a half a degree temperature change to put on a sweater or take off my socks, you know, whatever it might be. Just like everything has to be satisfied instantly. But I've really tried much more to just say, all right, so you're cold, so what? You know, just like, so what? And just start identifying with a larger reality, being a little tougher, whatever it might be. Anyway, slumbers are gone. Slumbers of sorrow are gone. I'm awake in bliss. So what difference does it make? That's where it came from. It says, "If all the gods are displeased, yet thou art pleased, I am safe in the fortress of thy pleasure." It's a very famous lines. "And if all the gods protect me behind the parapets of their blessings, yet I receive not thy benedictions, I am an orphan, left to pine spiritually in the ruins of thy displeasure." It's such a picture, isn't it? And there's a profound and absolutely deep truth here that we have to really understand. You know, once that relationship is formed with the master's going to take you to God, and there is no way around that. You're not going to be able to say, "I don't like this guy anymore. You know, I don't like this path anymore." Now, there's another truth to it too, which is, and I don't want to make people insecure, but you're not a disciple just because you said, "Hey, I think I'll be a disciple." You're a disciple because you have really committed yourself to this reality. You can't bind the guru lightly. And that's really what you have to understand. That's how Swami says it. You can't just declare yourself a disciple of Christ. Christ also has to accept you. And, of course, we try to make it like the guru's there for everyone, but he's not going to be bound to your liberation until you have bound yourself to your own liberation. That's why they often say, don't worry about looking for the guru, just make yourself a disciple. Make yourself a disciple, and then the guru will find you. And if you really want to have the guru's protection, you have to have that very serious relationship with him. We were talking about this in a different group early this morning. You can't just read a little here, read a little there, do this little practice, do that one, go get this, go get that. If you're not certain and you need to explore, you should definitely explore. Because once you really make a commitment, you need to really make a commitment. But then once you've made that, the guru is not bound to you unless you're also bound to him. And you have to really act on that commitment. And it's very subtle, and that's what they're saying here. If everybody else is pleased, it's not going to help you any. If every other book supports you, it's not going to help you any. What your master said to you, that's what's real. And you know, in our world here, where we don't have master embodied necessarily, it gets just a little bit trickier. But the master comes through the disciples who are in tune with him. And so you can't get out of it quite that easily. And God speaks to you as much through others as he speaks through your own heart. So there has to be this attitude of discipleship. This master, you teach me. You reach me, you teach me. You know, not I'm only going to listen to X, Y, or Z. It has to be very powerful. So they joke about it like this. If all the panoply of gods are protecting me, it won't do me any good, because if the guru is not pleased, I'm not where I need to be. And the other side of that is, you just work very conscientiously with what you do feel inside and what and what those that you learn to trust to be impartial channels for you. You know, you have to take both of it. And, you know, you read carefully, but you can't just go from books. You have to also work with individuals who are in tune with this. Otherwise, you can make it up too much. The great danger of our path is that people can make it up too much because Master's not here to correct us. So, but Master will correct us extremely actively through our Guru Bhais and through other disciples if we want that to happen. If our commitment to our liberation and our faith in our Master is strong enough, he will speak to you very directly. And not just through yourself, but through all the other ways. I was talking about this last night or the other night, that people imagine that if God can speak to me, he can only speak to me. You know, that it's like I'm the only one who can get guidance for me, that nobody else could get a true message from God. It's really kind of silly when you think about it. Why couldn't the people who love you and who are also dedicated to this path help you? It doesn't mean you blindly put yourself in anybody's hands, but you listen. We call it on our path cooperative obedience. Which is, you know, when you really get engaged in this path, you pledge cooperative obedience. That means I listen. My first impulse is to try to hear. But then it's cooperative because I don't do it mindlessly. Just because you have a position doesn't mean you control me. We work together. But you have to work in a bigger way than that. Because you can't, you don't want to be wrong on that. So to rely just too much only on yourself, just check your intuitions. I've had the great privilege in my life of having really good spiritual friends, which all of us have in these communities. And, you know, people who they weren't even necessarily like so far ahead of me on the path, but they were good, they are good, honest, true devotees. So it wouldn't be just a question of, tell me, I don't know. It would be like, does this make any sense? You know, does this seem like a good idea? And you know, if your friends are sincere, they'll say, I think you're a little mixed up on that one, or what about this? Think about that. You have the humility to test, but always with the thought, Master, talk to me. Tell me what, you know, help me here, because if you're not pleased, nothing is right. Oh, Guru, again, he's just always talking about these places where he was and now he isn't. Thou didst bring me out of the bottomless pit of darkness into the paradise of peace. So we've gone out of the slumber of sorrow into the wakefulness of joy, and the faggots have been lit, and my questions are answered in eternal satisfaction. It's just so marvelous. And then he said, our souls met after years of waiting. They trembled with an omnipresent thrill. We met here because we had met before. That's just so sweet, because what he's talking about is the mutuality of the relationship. How much the Master also loves having us. Remember also that story of Master where he was talking to Señor Cuarón, and he said, oh, I lost sight of you for a few lifetimes, but I'm not going to lose sight of you again. And sometimes Cuarón would say to Master, remember your promise, sir. You know, don't let me get lost again, Master would say, I remember. It's just so sweet, you know. And that's what we have also, is that, you know, this is a grand relationship, but it's also very dear, and it's reciprocal. It's receiving is also accepting the Master's love for us. That's why we have that beautiful chant, there is no other love like the Master's love for me. It's such a beautiful chant. It's hard for some people to understand that. But it's a real chant. There is no other love like the Master's love for me. But it's not that easy to accept it, because we have all these reasons why we just want to be a little, make me a saint but not yet, about things. Together we will fly to his shores, where we will smash our planes of finitude forever and vanish into infinite light. I bow to thee, and this is this beautiful phrase, as the spoken voice of silent God. Isn't that just, what beautiful poetry. I bow to thee as the spoken voice of silent God. I bow to thee as the divine door which leads to the temple of salvation. I bow to thee, and then he goes on from there, to thy master Lahiri Mahashaya, harbinger of yoga in Benares, and I lay the flowers of my devotion at the feet of Babaji, our Supreme Master. So also in this whole beautiful story, after all this concentration on Sri Yukteswar, he also goes back to the power that brought them all here. And also he ends it by, our Supreme Master is Babaji. Like the leader of the whole beautiful movement is Babaji. It's really quite something. And Master always said to our line of gurus, even though he called himself the preceptor and was definitely the guru, but his own turning of people's attention was to our line of gurus, because he never sort of wanted us even to concentrate too much on one personality, but to realize this whole flow of enormous energy coming down from the infinite. It's the ray. Swami used that word, which is one ray. I often think of them as windows laid one on the other, that, you know, just the same light comes through and the ray reaches you, and it just goes unchanged through all those forces. And as we often talk at our Guru Day retreat, you know, each one of those masters has a particular a vibration that they can also add to the picture, which, you know, it just gives us a lot to do. We were discussing that this morning, how much fun this path is because there's so much to do. Okay, I think that's all I have to say. Is there anything else?